Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for organizing this mingling of philosophers and psychologists. It's often an experiment how that works out. I am somebody who started doing research on wisdom, and that's probably one of the reasons why I'm here. So before talking about the ongoing work in progress, where I would really love to have your feedback on, let me first tell you a little bit about what I'm generally working on in this domain. I have several hats. One of them is wisdom, the other one is culture. So I study sort of the expression of wisdom in everyday life. I'm one of the first people in psychology who started doing that and started using experiments. I'm an experimental psychologist. And in many ways, it overlaps a lot with what Alessandra talked about earlier today. I'm not sure I would call it attitudes. I never thought about that. I still always thought about sort of, you know, behavioral expressions. We can't really measure traits, but we can measure behavior. It's also very difficult to measure people's self-assessments of something as grand as intellectual humility or being humble or perspective-taking abilities, because those people who claim to have the greatest ability to be humble, for instance, like Donald Trump, some of you may remember, often probably don't have that a lot. So that's why I prefer, as many behavioral scientists, to focus on behavior. And I think there doesn't have to be an inconsistency when we talk about traits, for instance, character traits, and their behavioral manifestations. In personality psychology, for instance, the one framework that I found very useful is a framework where you can view a trait as a density distribution of multiple snapshots, behavioral snapshots over time, and each person gets a profile, and so under some circumstances, these profiles may differ. So I found that quite useful, and I think I hope to talk more to you about this. Now, what I mean with wisdom, I often study things like intellectual humility, recognition of uncertainty and change. I focus on perspective taking, as well as integration of balance of different perspectives together. And what is really remarkable in the behavioral research is that these things often co-occur. So if one person is more likely to acknowledge limits of their knowledge and seek more information, this is the same person who tends to recognize different perspectives, and often tends to be the same person who focuses on the integration, synthesis of different points together. So if you want to know more about that, I had a few articles recently, review articles published on this topic that deal with sort of diary methods and experimental methods, where we show this again and again, this consistency of this forms of what I would call wise reasoning. It's not all that there is to wisdom, of course, and let's not get into the definitions that some philosophers like to get into. We had a lovely meeting sometime earlier where we spent, I think, half a day just talking about the definitions of wisdom, where philosophers and psychologists couldn't really agree. Which is probably fine, you know, if you're open-minded. One of the interesting things about this work and how it may be very well tied into this symposium that we have here is that we also found that, for instance, these forms of reasoning are linked to less polarized political attitudes. So, for instance, in one of the little studies that we did, gosh, long time ago, we thought this would be horrible when Barack Obama may not get elected against McCain. The golden times, I guess. So a few weeks before the presidential election, we asked strongly liberal and conservative students to come into the lab and read summaries of Democratic Republican parties, focus on two issues that they really care about, mostly care about. And then we did something, that experimental psychologists often like to do. We randomly assigned people to two different conditions. In one condition, people imagined a perspective of a US citizen living in the US. In another condition, an Icelandic citizen living in Iceland. And what do they do with these conditions? Well, from that perspective, they're supposed to imagine how will each issue that they mostly care about unfold if the person whom they don't endorse, so for liberals will be McCain, for conservatives will be Obama, will win the presidential election. And so they reflect, think out loud about it, and from those reflections, they try to figure out if they recognize limits of their knowledge. how the situation might unfold. Do they recognize that this type of events often tend to change over time? And what we found is that if you are taking the perspective of an Icelandic citizen, then people are more likely to both show intellectual humility and recognize change, recognize this uncertainty in the social affairs. Now, that is neat. Shows probably that this was the first study that experimentally showed that these forms of virtues, if you want, can be experimentally manipulated and form a psychological distance plays a role. But what we also did, and that may be related to this symposium, we asked people if they would be willing to join a bipartisan group. So then, by the way, there is this bipartisan group on campus. If you are interested to join, totally up to you, just leave your email somewhere in this document. And one third of the people in this distant group left the email. Only three people in the immersed group left the email. Turns out that in turn, this willingness to leave the email and engage with a bipartisan group was related to their tendency to be intellectually humble and open-minded, so to say, and statistically explain the experimental effect of distance. So as I said, if you want to know more about this, I welcome you to produce some of the recent work that we published. Since that little study, we've done a number of experimental manipulations, where in each single case, it seems like either an interpersonal domain or in societal domains, thinking about economics, thinking about your interpersonal past transgressions, if you engage in the forms of like temporal distance, think about it a year from now versus here now, observe a vantage point, take a perspective of a third person visually versus first person through your own eyes, or even such a thing as a self-talk in the third person. So it's like, what would Igor do? How would he think about this problem? In each case, that leads to a little wisdom boost. It leads to greater intellectual humility. It leads to greater recognition of different perspectives and integration of those perspectives. Now, the thing, it seems like I'm the person who should know how to deal with difficult, complex situations under which this type of humility is needed. Nevertheless, this did not prepare me for what happened last year. So when people ask me, how would you explain something like Brexit or 2016 US presidential election, my reaction is the same as of Hillary Clinton, I don't know. But that led me to an interesting new line of research. And in fact, it happened before the Brexit. I was just interested in other ways to manipulate and promote wisdom beyond what I've done. I thought one natural one would be to consider how maybe people who are in the role of explaining something may be reasoning. And turns out there's not that much work on that. We know some things about teaching. We know a lot about how to teach. There's still a bit of debate about how to teach. Of course, some of you in philosophy know Rousseau and his treatment of teaching and education of the youth. Montessori, Vygotsky in psychology was very fundamental for changing the way how we think. And Piaget, of course, was also there. But all of that seems to be focusing on the students and their development. And the question that I was interested in is, how does adopting sort of a teacher's role, when you are in a position where you have to explain, let's say, Brexit or the election, changes or maybe it does not change your reasoning? And does it make you wiser or does it make you more defensive? And it seems like it could go both ways. So let me use a simple analogy. And I apologize to those of you who know much more about sophists. You can imagine that teaching could be viewed in a very sort of rhetorical and didactic fashion. And I just tell somebody what to do and what is the right thing to do and what is the right way to think about a particular topic, okay? Or you can take an approach that I would call it, for the lack of a better word, Socratic. Socrates sought knowledge and truth. He was asking questions. He denied his role as a teacher. He said, I'm not a teacher. I'm no one's teacher. What do you want from me? By the way, talking about being an asshole, an intellectual asshole, I think Socrates was not an intellectual asshole. I'm not sure about the other one. Like, if you know about Socrates, but again, I apologize for a very simplistic interpretation of this. Now, what is interesting about in this very simplistic interpretation, it presents the model. On the one hand, the sophist model would be represented with high self-investment in one's view, where you want to tell somebody what to do, what is the right thing. Whereas in Socrates' case, it seems like he emphasizes a fairly low self-investment in his views. And I wanted to know, how do people do it, lay people do it in their everyday life? Now, we know a little bit in psychology about that. We know a little bit about the benefits of teaching. Classic studies suggest on birth order effects, suggest that if all the siblings, when they teach younger siblings, that may make them smarter. There are developmental theories in psychology, like Erikson. There's some work by Dan McAdams in personality psychology, suggest that if you teach others, it is a behavioral manifestation of a certain life phase of generativity. What that means is that you have a motivation to guide the next generation, this motivation sort of is a precursor of development of wisdom and balance in your viewpoints about social life. It's very sort of normative stage theory, without much experimental evidence to that. In education research, we know that tutoring others can facilitate more effective learning. And then some of you may know Tanya Lombroso's work in experimental philosophy and developmental psychology, who has studied explanation patterns and has shown that if you explain something to somebody else, just being in that mindset of explaining things, it facilitates on a very basic cognitive level your pattern recognition, pattern discovery, and improves your inferences, your cognitive inferences, if you're presented with simple cognitive problems. My question is, like, does it generalize to social issues like explaining Brexit or the outcomes of the US election? And here becomes a little bit more complicated. Even though it seems like in a cognitive domain there are some benefits of teaching or being in a position of teaching, in social psychology we do know that if you are asked to explain something to somebody else, it can actually lead to more extreme attitudes. Because you may be defensive, as Alessandro already suggested, you may be willing to defend your sense of self and justify your judgment, and that may actually lead to more of this kind of sophist approach. There is some support for that even in cognitive science and philosophy, in epistemology, Mercier and Sperber, in their recent work when they talked about the argumentative theory of human reasoning. They suggest that the argumentation, basically the reason why we are subject to confirmation bias is because it's actually very effective if you think about reasoning as reasoning for the sake of argumentation with somebody else. So if you take it out of that context, it seems like a bias. If you think about it in that context, it seems highly effective to achieve what you want to achieve, namely to convince other people. But from that perspective, of course, it seems like we would be sophists when we try to explain issues to somebody who is less knowledgeable, when we try to teach others. At the same time, explaining things to somebody else can help us to realize how little we actually know about the topic. Particularly if the topic is complex, that may lead to this realization of your intellectual depth, lack of intellectual depth. And that in turn can promote a balanced perspective on this particular topic. And that has been demonstrated, for instance, by another cognitive science, Sloman, who together with some colleagues has demonstrated that people who have less of an illusion of explanatory depth of a phenomena, so they are more likely to recognize that they don't know something, these people are less polarized in their opinions on a political topic, for instance.
That's Steve Sloman, right?
Steve Sloman, yes. That's correct. So that led me to a question that I want to quickly address today. How do people spontaneously teach or advise others? In my opinion, but I may be wrong, there's not that much empirical work on this topic. Does it lead to polarized inclusive reasoning, and under what conditions? And I will start to tackle addressing the question, what could be the possible underlying mechanisms explaining it. I will not satisfactorily, in my opinion, be able to address it. It's an ongoing project, but we'll start addressing it. And there's a set of possible candidates, could be psychological distance. You can be more positive when you talk to somebody who is less knowledgeable. You may be more deliberate. You may be more motivated to be generative, in the sense of really motivated to teach the next generation. Or maybe you're just less self-invested. Very simple setup. There are two studies. One is a large-scale study at the 2012 presidential election, the night of the third debate between Romney and Obama. Presidential debate. You name three domestic political issues. You rate how much you care about them. Then we pick the one that you cared mostly about, and you write about this issue using different manipulations. A second study, pre-registered extension of this to 2016 presidential election. We had to wait 4 years, unfortunately. We can't really do replication that easily with this type of events. And here we rate in the summer how much. Participants rate how much they cared about gun control and wrote about gun control, which was a particularly salient issue for Americans in June of 2016. So let's look at this first study. It's 886 U.S. Americans. It's exactly after this third debate. They are randomly assigned to three conditions. And two of these conditions, they are assigned to the conditions of discussing things with either 12-year-old or somebody who is new to the country. So it's very subtle manipulation of explaining it to somebody who is less knowledgeable. And in fact, we were able to confirm that with a preliminary check, that they were more likely to be really explaining the mechanism. The third condition is, we just wanted to know what happens if people start to think about it, knowing that this will be read by somebody else. So there is a little bit of a demand for explanation, but really you're focusing on your own thoughts. So just write down your own thoughts about it. And then we coded this response. So this is content analysis, which means that each of these 886 statements that participants produced, written statements, was read by at least two or three people who tried to reach an agreement on it, and that required some calibration, and classified into one of the four categories. They either not present any framing of an issue as an opinion, or present one opinion. They present several opinions, but just discount those that they don't like. They present several opinions and provide details for each opinion, or they even present several opinions and try to integrate them together. Let me guide you through them. What does that look like? For instance, no single opinion could be, this is Romney and Obama discussion, people have started to feel that they are being taxed to death. All politicians vote to raise taxes, but after elected, they always do. So this is just a kind of a general statement. There's a single opinion, there is no discussion. Discounting looks something like that. Some people think it's a good idea to change the healthcare system, but I think it's a horrible idea. In the end, I will receive sanitized care, the same kind they give cattle. Okay. Then the third one, presenting multiple perspectives. Obama and Romney have different ideas for what the best way to boost the U.S. economy is. Obama's policy leans more towards reducing benefits of the upper class. Romney's policy benefits upper class people. And finally, the fourth one, some people want to give rich people tax cuts because they think it will help the economy. Others think it will actually hurt a lot of people and not help the economy. Both outcomes are possible, but it depends on how you look at it. So there's kind of a little bit of this kind of way to integrate it together. So arguably, and you'll see it in the data, in the results, these two are often going together. And not that many people really get at their integration, in part because it's probably very difficult to express it in writing in a short paragraph. So what do the results look like? So this will be a simple representation of expected values and their significance in different conditions. So what we find here is that in adolescent and immigrant condition, there are more people who focus on multiple perspectives and integration, people focusing mainly on those explanations and less on discounting. Whereas in the control, normally when you think out loud about it, you majorly focus on discounting and much less likely focus on multiple perspectives and integration. So this difference between on the one hand, multiple perspectives, and on the other hand, discounting is salient when you compare what you normally think about when you think out loud about it versus when you think about discussing it with a 12-year-old person new to the country. A different way to look at this is that in this kind of what I would call baseline condition, what do people think about when they reflect on an issue? About 80% of the people think about discounting or not presenting different opinions at all. And if you are explaining it to somebody, then about 40% of the people are actually presenting multiple opinions and integrate them together. So it's kind of 50, almost half of the people are engaged in this kind of Socratic style of thinking. Now, this is, of course, a very preliminary study because even though we showed that there are fewer discounting narratives for those in a kind of teaching mindset and greater acknowledgement of multiple perspectives, one critical thing for experimental psychologists is that there is not clear control condition. That was just like the first way to test it. A clearer control condition would be getting somebody who is at least as knowledgeable as you are as a control. So comparing it, for instance, to a peer. And the other thing that we wanted to check again in this follow-up is the different mechanisms. What could be, if there is this phenomenon, what could be explaining this difference? Is it because people are more detached when they think about explaining it to a 12-year-old? Is it because they talk different to explain things differently to a 12-year-old? Are they motivated to teach somebody, as I presented earlier? That could be another theory. So we did this in 2016. Recruited about 600 U.S. participants across 4 days of end of June, when the gun control issue dominated the U.S. Debate. And here they described the political issue, and we have two conditions. We focused on the imagine discussing it with a 12-year-old versus imagine discussing with another MTurk worker, another peer, whom you arguably would assume has a similar amount of knowledge as you do. And again, the responses were coded by two or three independent raters on these four dimensions. So what do we find here? Basically replicate this effect, where when you explain the things to a 12-year-old, you're more likely to acknowledge multiple perspectives and integrate them together as compared to discounting and not frame it as an opinion. And in the control, when you explain it to a peer, you're less likely to acknowledge multiple perspectives and integrate, you're more likely to discount. And again, the critical difference is specifically when you compare how many people acknowledge multiple perspectives with sufficient amount of information. And presented differently, pretty much the same if you compare to that previous control where 80% of the people just discounted or presented one opinion. Same thing happens when you explain it or when you discuss it with a peer. You just think about it in terms of discounting. Whereas 39% in the explaining to another lesson to a 12-year-old are likely to acknowledge multiple perspectives, engage in this in an open-minded fashion. So very much, very nice replication of the previous finding. Now, what about the mechanisms here? Oh, this is another way to show it. If you like this type of graphs, what this shows is basically on a scale from 1 to 4 and standardized scores that pretty much a nice replication of the first study. What about the mechanisms? So we tested the psychological distance. We looked at language, how positive were the words in the language of what people wrote about, the length of deliberation, the amount of time people spent deliberating on the issue. We asked questions about self-investment, and we created a questionnaire for state-level generative motivation, so your willingness to teach others. And I can tell you that either was the path from the experimental condition to this process not significant, there was no relationship, or it was even in the opposite direction, but out of the five that we tested, only the path from adolescent to peer and peer versus peer to motivations made sense. Now specifically, let me tell you a little bit about this motivations. We asked people, seven item questionnaire, when you were thinking about it, to what extent did you try to teach and guide the other person? To what extent did you guide this person towards understanding the situation? So the scale was highly reliable, which means that, as psychologists often do, we collapsed it into one item, and we looked at this index score, collapsed index score, averaged index score. Now, what is interesting is that this would be, for instance, the path from condition. You experimentally assign people to peer versus adolescent, to generativity, to this kind of integrative, more open-minded reasoning. And we found the effect from condition to generativity. Sure enough, people were more willing to explain and to teach the next generation when it was really a 12-year-old versus a peer. But we did not find a direct path between generativity and integrative reasoning. And if you think about the way how I told you about the Socratic versus the sophist approaches, it's not really given that sophists are unwilling to teach. Of course, they're willing to teach. However, they're very self-invested in how they want to teach. So here's the raw data of the relationship between self-investment, generativity, and differently coded responses. And what I would like, the way you want to interpret this, is not very, even for psychologists, not very straightforward. That's the best way to represent it because it's a raw data without any manipulation, is that if you are low in self-investment, then the more generative you are, the more likely you are to integrate perspectives together and consider multiple perspectives instead of thinking about single opinions. You see that these two are higher in terms of generativity. But if you are becoming more self-invested, that there is no differentiation. There is no relationship between generativity and your open-mindedness when you're high in self-investment. And when we acknowledge this and run a model in which we account for self-investment, even though I have to acknowledge this was a post-hoc explanation. So we just we tried to different models where this was very exploratory. This model indeed was significant, which means that under conditions of low self-investment, the reason why explaining things to an adolescent led to more open-minded reflections was because the people were more generative. However, that was not the case when you're highly self-invested. So to put this together, many people, well, at least 40% in our samples, very large samples, I would say for psychological experiments, tend to be Socratic when discussing issues with less knowledgeable. And we demonstrated this effect of the teaching mindset, I would call it, on political issues in two field experiments. But this, so far, and this is just so far, research suggests that it's not simply because people are motivated to teach others. Because you can be motivated to teach others and basically convince them of that you're right. Rather, it's the combination of being generative and low in less invested in your own viewpoints that explained the relationship between being in a teaching mindset and open-mindedness, intellectual humility, so to say, in your reasoning. Now, I would like to acknowledge a few people here. Two of my students are currently on the job or postdoc market, Alex and Henry. So in case you want to have somebody who can do experiments on intellectual humility and is well versed in cognitive science, big data analytics, and social psychology, either of them could be your man. And I would like to acknowledge my funders. Thank you so much.